Chapter 4. As Frank Frink watched his ex-employer waddle down the corridor and into the main work area of WM Corporation, he thought to himself, "The strange thing about Wyndham Matson is that he does not look like a man who owns a factory. He looks like a tenderloin bum, a wino, who has been given a bath, new clothes, a shave, haircut, shot of vitamins, and set out into the world with $5 to find a new life." The old man had a weak, shifty, nervous, even ingratiating manner, as if he regarded everyone as a potential enemy stronger than he, whom he had to fawn on and pacify. "They're going to get me," his manner seemed to say. And yet, old W.M. was really very powerful. He owned controlling interests in a variety of enterprises, speculations, real estate, as well as the W.M. Corporation factory. Following after the old man, Frink pushed open the big metal door to the main work area. The rumble of machinery, which he had heard around him every day for so long, sight of men at the machines, air filled with flash of light, waste dust, movement. There went the old man. Frink increased his pace.
"Hey, Mr. W.M.," he called.
The old man had stopped by the hairy-armed shop foreman, Ed McCarthy. Both of them glanced up as Frink came toward them. Moistening his lips nervously, Wyndham Manson said,
"I'm sorry, Frank. I can't do anything about taking you back. I've already gone ahead and hired someone to take your place, thinking you weren't coming back, after what you said."
His small round eyes flickered with what Frink knew to be an almost hereditary evasiveness. It was in the old man's blood. Frink said, "I came for my tools, nothing else." His own voice, he was glad to hear, was firm, even harsh.
"Well, let's see,"
W.M. mumbled, obviously hazy in his own mind as to the status of Frink's tools. To Ed McCarthy he said,
"I think that would be in your department, Ed. Maybe you can fix Frank here up. I have other business."
He glanced at his pocket watch.
"Listen, Ed, I'll discuss that invoice later. I have to run along."
He patted Ed McCarthy on the arm and then trotted off, not looking back. Ed McCarthy and Frink stood together.
"You came to get your job back," McCarthy said after a time.
"Yes,"
Frink said.
"I was proud of what you said yesterday."
"So was I," Frink said.
"But, Christ, I can't work it out anywhere else."
He felt defeated and hopeless. "You know that." The two of them had, in the past, often talked over their problems. McCarthy said,
"I don't know that. You're as good with that flex cable machine as anybody on the coast. I've seen you whip out a piece in 5 minutes, including the rouge polishing, all the way from the rough Cradex, and except for the welding."
"I never said I could weld," Frink said.
"Did you ever think of going into business on your own?"
Frink, taken by surprise, stammered,
"What doing?"
"Jewelry."
"Ah, for Christ's sake."
"Custom original pieces, not commercial."
McCarthy beckoned him over to a corner of the shop, away from the noise. "For about $2,000 you could set up a little basement or garage shop. One time I drew up designs for women's earrings and pendants. You remember, real modern contemporary."
Taking scratch paper, he began to draw, slowly, grimly.
Peering over his shoulder, Frink saw a bracelet design, an abstract with flowing lines.
"Is there a market?"
All he had ever seen were the traditional, even antique, objects from the past.
"Nobody wants contemporary American. There isn't any such thing, not since the war."
"Create a market,"
McCarthy said with an angry grimace.
"You mean sell it myself?"
"Take it into retail shops. Like that, what's it called, on Montgomery Street, that big ritzy art object place."
"American artistic handcrafts," Frink said.
He never went into fashionable, expensive stores such as that. Few Americans did. It was the Japanese who had the money to buy from such places.
"You know what retailers like that are selling?"
McCarthy said.
"And getting a fortune for? Those goddamn silver belt buckles from New Mexico that the Indians make. Those goddamn tourist trash pieces all alike. Supposedly native art."
For a long time, Frink regarded McCarthy.
"I know what else they sell," he said finally. "And so do you."
"Yes,"
McCarthy said. They both knew, because they had both been directly involved, and for a long time. WM Corporation's stated legal business consisted in turning out wrought iron staircases, railings, fireplaces, and ornaments for new apartment buildings, all on a mass basis from standard designs. For a new 40-unit building, the same piece would be executed 40 times in a row. Ostensibly, WM Corporation was an iron foundry. But, in addition, it maintained another business, from which its real profits were derived. Using an elaborate variety of tools, materials, and machines, WM Corporation turned out a constant flow of forgeries of pre-war American artifacts. These forgeries were cautiously but expertly fed into the wholesale art object market to join the genuine objects collected throughout the continent. As in the stamp and coin business, no one could possibly estimate the percentage of forgeries in circulation. And no one, especially the dealers and the collectors themselves, wanted to. When Frink had quit, there lay half-finished on his bench a Colt revolver of the frontier period. He had made the molds himself, done the casting, and had been busy hand-smoothing the pieces. There was an unlimited market for small arms of the American Civil War and frontier period. WM Corporation could sell all that Frink could turn out. It was his specialty. Walking slowly over to his bench, Frink picked up the still rough and burred ramrod of the revolver. Another 3 days and the gun would be finished. Yes, he thought, it was good work. An expert could have told the difference, but the Japanese collectors weren't authorities in the proper sense, had no standards or tests by which to judge. In fact, as far as he knew, it had never occurred to them to ask themselves if the so-called historic art objects for sale in West Coast shops were genuine. Perhaps someday they would, and then the bubble would burst, the market would collapse even for the authentic pieces. A Gresham's Law, the fakes would undermine the value of the real. And that, no doubt, was the motive for the failure to investigate. After all, everyone was happy. The factories, here and there in the various cities, which turned out the pieces, they made their profits. The wholesalers passed them on, and the dealers displayed and advertised them. The collectors shelled out their money and carried their purchases happily home, to impress their associates, friends, and mistresses. Like post-war boodle paper money, it was fine until questioned. Nobody was hurt, until the day of reckoning. And then everyone equally would be ruined. But meanwhile, nobody talked about it. Even the men who earned their living turning out the forgeries, they shut their own minds to what they made, kept their attention on the mere technical problems. "How long since you tried to do original designing?" McCarthy asked. Frink shrugged. "Years. I can copy accurately as hell, but..." "You know what I think? I think you've picked up the Nazi idea that Jews can't create, that they can only imitate and sell. Middlemen." He fixed his merciless scrutiny on Frink. "Maybe so," Frink said. "Try it. Do some original designs, or work directly on the metal. Play around, like a kid plays." "No," Frink said. "You have no faith," McCarthy said. "You've completely lost faith in yourself, right? Too bad, because I know you could do it." He walked away from the workbench. "It is too bad," Frink thought. "But nevertheless, it's the truth. It's a fact. I can't get faith or enthusiasm by willing it, deciding to." That McCarthy, he thought, is a damn good shop foreman. He has the knack of needling a man, getting him to put out his best efforts, to do his utmost in spite of himself. He's a natural leader. He almost inspired me for a moment there. But McCarthy had gone off now. The effort had failed. "Too bad I don't have my copy of the Oracle here," Frink thought. "I could consult it on this, take the issue to it for its 5,000 years of wisdom." And then he recalled that there was a copy of the I Ching in the lounge of the business office of WM Corporation. So he made his way from the work area, along the corridor, hurriedly through the business office to the lounge. Seated in one of the chrome and plastic lounge chairs, he wrote his question out on the back of an envelope. "Should I attempt to go into the creative private business outlined to me just now?" And then he began throwing the coins. The bottom line was a 7, and so was the second, and then the third. The bottom trigram in Qian, he realized. That sounded good. Qian was the creative. Then line 4, an 8, Yin, and line 5, also 8, a Yin line. "Good Lord," he thought excitedly. "One more Yin line, and I've got hexagram 11. Tie. Peace." Very favorable judgment. Or, his hands trembled as he rattled the coins, a yang line, and hence hexagram 26, ta chu, the taming power of the great. Both have favorable judgments, and it has to be one or the other. He threw the 3 coins. Yin, a 6. It was peace. Opening the book, he read the judgment. Peace. The small departs. The great approaches. Good fortune. Success. So I ought to do as Ed McCarthy says, open my little business. Now the six at the top, my one moving line. He turned the page. What was the text? He could not recall. Probably favorable, because the hexagram itself was so favorable. Union of heaven and earth. But the first and last lines were outside the hexagram always, so possibly the six at the top. His eyes picked out the line, read it in a flash. The wall falls back into the moat. Use no army now. Make your commands known within your own town. Perseverance brings humiliation. My busted back! He exclaimed, horrified. And the commentary. The change alluded to in the middle of the hexagram has begun to take place. The wall of the town sinks back into the moat from which it was dug. The hour of doom is at hand. It was, beyond doubt, one of the most dismal lines in the entire book, of more than 3,000 lines. And yet the judgment of the hexagram was good. Which was he supposed to follow? And how could they be so different? It had never happened to him before. Good fortune and doom mixed together in the oracle's prophecy. What a weird fate, as if the oracle had scraped the bottom of the barrel, tossed up every sort of rag, bone, and turd of the dark, then reversed itself and poured in the light like a cook gone barmy. I must have pressed two buttons at once, he decided. Jammed the works and got this Schlemazel's-eye view of reality. Just for a second, fortunately. Didn't last. Hell, he thought, it has to be one or the other. It can't be both. You can't have good fortune and doom simultaneously. Or can you? The jewelry business will bring good fortune. The judgment refers to that. But the line, the goddamn line, it refers to something deeper. Some future catastrophe, probably not even connected with the jewelry business. Some evil fate that's in store for me, anyhow. War, he thought. Third World War. All frigging 2 billion of us killed. Our civilization wiped out. Hydrogen bombs falling like hail. My gavalt, he thought. What's happening? Did I start it in motion? Or is someone else tinkering? Someone I don't even know? Or the whole lot of us? It's the fault of those physicists and that synchronicity theory, every particle being connected with every other. You can't fart without changing the balance in the universe. It makes living a funny joke with nobody around to laugh. I open a book and get a report on future events that even God would like to file and forget. And who am I? The wrong person, I can tell you that. I should take my tools, get my motors from McCarthy, open my shop, start my piddling business, go on despite the horrible line. Be working, creating in my own way, right up to the end, living as best I can, as actively as possible, until the wall falls back into the moat for all of us, all mankind. That's what the oracle is telling me. Fate will pull axis eventually anyhow, but I have my job in the meantime. I must use my mind, my hands. The judgment was for me alone, for my work. But the line, it was for us all. I'm too small, he thought. I can only read what's written, glance up, and then lower my head and plod along where I left off, as if I hadn't seen. The oracle doesn't expect me to start running up and down the streets, squalling and yammering for public attention. Can anyone alter it? He wondered. All of us combined, or one great figure, or someone strategically placed, who happens to be in the right spot. Chance. Accident. And our lives, our world, hanging on it. Closing the book, he left the lounge and walked back to the main work area. When he caught sight of McCarthy, he waved him over to one side where they could resume talk. The more I think about it, Frink said, the more I like your idea. Fine, McCarthy said. Now listen, here's what you do. You have to get money from Wyndham Matson. He winked, a slow, intense, frightened twitch of his eyelid. I figured out how. I'm going to quit and go in with you. My design, see? What's wrong with that? I know they're good. Sure, Frank said, a little dazed. I'll see you after work tonight, McCarthy said, at my apartment. You come over around 7 and have dinner with Jean and me, if you can stand the kids. Okay, Frank said. McCarthy gave him a slap on the shoulder and went off. I've gone a long way, Frank said to himself, in the last 10 minutes. But he did not feel apprehensive. He felt, now, excitement. It sure happened fast, he thought as he walked over to his bench and began collecting his tools. I guess that's how those kinds of things happen. Opportunity, when it comes.
All my life I've waited for this. When the oracle says something must be achieved, it means this. The time is truly great. What is the time now? What is this moment?
6 at the top in hexagram 11 changes everything to 26, taming power of the great. Yin becomes yang. The line moves and a new moment appears. And I was so off stride I didn't even notice.
I'll bet that's why I got that terrible line. That's the only way hexagram 11 can change to hexagram 26, by that moving 6 at the top. So I shouldn't get my ass in such an uproar.
But despite his excitement and optimism, he could not get the line completely out of his mind.
However, he thought ironically, I'm making a damn good try. By 7 tonight, maybe I'll have managed to forget it like it never happened.
He thought, I sure hope so, because this get-together with Ed is big. He's got some surefire idea, I can tell, and I don't intend to find myself left out.
Right now I'm nothing, but if I can swing this, then maybe I can get Juliana back. I know what she wants. She deserves to be married to a man who matters, an important person in the community, not some mashugana. Men used to be men in the old days, before the war, for instance, but all that's gone now. No wonder she roams around from place to place, from man to man, seeking, and not even knowing what it is herself, what her biology needs. But I know, and through this big-time action with McCarthy, whatever it is, I'm going to achieve it for her.
At lunchtime, Robert Shulden closed up American Artistic Handcrafts, Inc. Usually he crossed the street and ate at the coffee shop. In any case, he stayed away no more than half an hour, and today he was gone only 20 minutes. Memory of his ordeal with Mr. Tagomi and the staff of the trade mission still kept his stomach upset. As he returned to his store, he said to himself, "Perhaps new policy of not making calls. Do all business within store." 2 hours showing, much too long, almost 4 hours in all, too late to reopen store. An entire afternoon to sell one item, one Mickey Mouse watch, expensive treasure, but... He unlocked the store door, propped it open, went to hang up his coat in the rear. When he re-emerged, he found that he had a customer, a white man. Well, he thought, surprise.
"Good day, sir,"
Shulden said, bowing slightly. Probably a Pinnock, slender, rather dark man, well-dressed, fashionable, but not at ease, slight shine of perspiration.
"Good day," the man murmured, moving around the store to inspect the displays. Then, all at once, he approached the counter. He reached into his coat, produced a small, shiny leather card case, set down a multicolored, elaborately printed card. On the card, the imperial emblem and military insignia, the Navy, Admiral Harusha. Robert Shulden examined it, impressed.
"The Admiral's ship," the customer explained, "lies in San Francisco Bay at this moment. The carrier, Siokaku."
"Ah,"
Shulden said. "Admiral Harusha has never before visited the West Coast," the customer explained. "He has many wishes while here, one of which is to pay personal visit to your famous store. All the time in the home islands he has heard of American Artistic Handcrafts, Incorporated." Shulden bowed with delight. "However," the man continued, "due to pressure of appointments, the Admiral cannot pay personal visit to your esteemed store, but he has sent me. I am his gentleman."
"The Admiral is a collector?"
Shulden said, his mind working at top speed.
"He is a lover of the arts. He is a connoisseur, but not a collector. What he desires is for gift purposes. To wit, he wishes to present each officer of his ship a valuable historic artifact, a sidearm of the epic American Civil War."
The man paused.
"There are 12 officers in all."
To himself, Shulden thought, 12 Civil War sidearms? Cost to buyer almost $10,000. He trembled.
"As is well known," the man continued, "your shop sells such priceless antique artifacts from the pages of American history, alas, all too rapidly vanishing into limbo of time."
Taking enormous care in his words, he could not afford to lose this, to make one single slip, Shulden said,
"Yes, it is true. Of all the stores in PSA, I possess finest stock imaginable of Civil War weapons. I will be happy to serve Admiral Harusha. Shall I gather a superb collection of such and bring aboard the Siokaku? This afternoon, possibly?"
The man said, "No, I should inspect them here."
12, Shulden computed. He did not possess 12, in fact he had only 3, but he could acquire 12, if luck were with him, through various channels within the week. Air Express from the East, for instance, and local wholesale contacts.
You, sir, Sheldon said, are knowledgeable in such weapons?
Tolerably, the man said. I have a small collection of hand weapons, including tiny secret pistol made to look like domino, circa 1840.
Exquisite item, Sheldon said,
as he went to the locked safe to get several guns for Admiral Harush's gentleman's inspection. When he returned, he found the man writing out a bank check. The man paused and said, The Admiral desires to pay in advance, a deposit of 15,000 PSA dollars. The room swam before Children's eyes, but he managed to keep his voice level. He even made himself sound a trifle bored.
If you wish, it is not necessary, a mere formality of business.
Laying down a leather and felt box, he said,
Here is exceptional Colt 44 of 1860.
He opened the box.
Black powder and ball. This issued to U.S. Army. Boys in blue carried these into, for instance, Second Bull Run.
For a considerable time, the man examined the Colt 44. Then, lifting his eyes, he said calmly, Sir, this is an imitation.
Eh?
Sheldon said, not comprehending. This piece is no older than 6 months. Sir, your offering is a fake. I am cast into gloom. But see, the wood here, artificially aged by an acid chemical. What a shame. He laid the gun down. Sheldon picked the gun up and stood holding it between his hands. He could think of nothing to say. Turning the gun over and over, he said at last,
It can't be.
An imitation of the authentic historic gun. Nothing more. I am afraid, sir, you have been deceived. Perhaps by some unscrupulous churl. You must report this to the San Francisco police. The man bowed. It grieves me. You may have other imitations, too, in your shop. Is it possible, sir, that you, the owner, dealer in such items, cannot distinguish the forgeries from the real? There was silence. Reaching down, the man picked up the half-completed check which he had been making out. He returned it to his pocket, put his pen away, and bowed. It is a shame, sir, but I clearly cannot, alas, conduct my business with American Artistic Handcrafts Incorporated, after all. Admiral Harusho will be disappointed. Nevertheless, you can see my position. Children stared down at the gun. Good day, sir, the man said. Please accept my humbly meant advice. Hire some expert to scrutinize your acquisitions. Your reputation, I am sure you understand. Children mumbled.
Sir, if you could please...
Be tranquil, sir. I will not mention this to anyone. I shall tell the Admiral that unfortunately your shop was closed today. After all, the man paused at the doorway. We are both, after all, white men. Bowing once more, he departed. Alone, Sheldon stood holding the gun. It can't be, he thought. But it must be. Good God in heaven, I am ruined. I have lost a $15,000 sale. And my reputation, if this gets out... If that man, Admiral Harush's gentleman, is not discreet, I will kill myself, he decided. I have lost place. I cannot go on. That is a fact. On the other hand, perhaps that man erred. Perhaps he lied. He was sent by United States Historic Objects to destroy me, or by West Coast Art Exclusives. Anyhow, one of my competitors. The gun is no doubt genuine. How can I find out? Sheldon racked his brains. Ah, I will have the gun analyzed at the University of California Penology Department. I know someone there, or at least I once did. This matter came up before once. Alleged non-authenticity of ancient breech loader. In haste, he telephoned one of the city's bonded messenger and delivery services, told them to send a man over at once. Then he wrapped the gun and wrote out a note to the university lab, telling them to make professional estimate of the gun's age at once and inform him by phone. The delivery man arrived. Sheldon gave him the note and parcel, the address, and told him to go by helicopter. The man departed, and Sheldon began pacing about his store, waiting, waiting. At 3 o'clock, the university called.
Mr. Sheldon, the voice said, you wanted this weapon tested for authenticity, this 1860 Army Model Colt 44.
A pause while Sheldon gripped the phone with apprehension.
Here's the lab report. It's a reproduction cast from plastic molds, except for the walnut.
Serial numbers all wrong. The frame not case-hardened by the cyanide process. Both brown and blue surfaces, achieved by a modern quick-acting technique, the whole gun artificially aged, given a treatment to make it appear old and worn. Children said thickly,
"The man who brought it to me for appraisal."
"Tell him he's been taken," the university technician said. "And very taken. It's a good job, done by a real pro. See, the authentic gun was given its, you know, the blue metal parts. Those were put in a box of leather strips, sealed with cyanide gas and heated. Too cumbersome nowadays. But this was done in a fairly well-equipped shop. We detected particles of several polishing and finishing compounds, some quite unusual. Now, we can't prove this, but we know there's a regular industry turning out these fakes. There must be. We've seen so many."
"No," Childen said. "That is only a rumor. I can state that to you as absolute fact, sir."
His voice rose and broke screechingly.
"And I am in a position to know. Why do you think I sent it to you? I could perceive its fakery, being qualified by years of training. Such as this is a rarity, an oddity. Actually, a joke, a prank."
He broke off, panting.
"Thank you for confirming my own observations. You will bill me. Thank you."
He rang off at once. Then, without pausing, he got out his records. He began tracing the gun. How had it come to him? From whom? It had come, he discovered, from one of the largest wholesale suppliers in San Francisco, Ray Calvin Associates on Van Ness. At once he phoned them.
"Let me talk to Mr. Calvin," he said.
His voice had now become a trifle steadier. Presently a gruff voice, very busy.
"Yes?"
"This is Bob Childen, at AAH Inc. on Montgomery. Ray, I have a matter of delicacy. I wish to see you. Private conference. Sometime today in your office or etc. Believe me, sir, you had better heed my request."
Now he discovered he was bellowing into the phone.
"Okay,"
Ray Calvin said.
"Tell no one. This is absolutely confidential."
4 o'clock.
4 it is, Childen said. "At your office. Good day."
He slammed the receiver down so furiously that the entire phone fell from the counter to the floor. Kneeling, he gathered it up and replaced it in its spot. There was half an hour ahead before he should start. He had all that time to pace, helpless, waiting. What to do? An idea. He phoned the San Francisco office of the Tokyo Herald on Market Street.
"Sirs," he said, "please tell me if the carrier Siakaku is in the harbor, and if so, how long. I would appreciate this information from your estimable newspaper."
An agonizing wait. Then the girl was back.
"According to our reference room, sir," she said in a giggling voice, "the Kerio Siakaku is at the bottom of the Philippine Sea. It was sunk by an American submarine in 1945. Any more questions we can help you with, sir?"
Obviously they, at the newspaper office, appreciated the wild goose variety of prank that had been played on him. He hung up. No Kerio Siakaku for 17 years. Probably no Admiral Harusha. The man had been an impostor. And yet, the man had been right. The Colt 44 was a fake. It did not make sense. Perhaps the man was a speculator. He had been trying to corner the market in Civil War period sidearms. An expert. And he had recognized the fake. He was the professional of professionals. It would take a professional to know. Someone in the business. Not a mere collector. Childen felt a tiny measure of relief. Then few others would detect. Perhaps no one else. Secret safe. Let matter drop? He considered. No, must investigate. First of all, get back investment, get reimbursement from Ray Calvin, and must have all other artifacts in stock examined by university lab. But suppose many of them are non-authentic. Difficult matter. Only way is this, he decided. He felt grim, even desperate. Go to Ray Calvin, confront him, insist that he pursue matter back to source. Maybe he is innocent, too. Maybe not. In any case, tell him no more fakes or I will not buy through him ever again. He will have to absorb the loss, Childen decided, not I. If he will not, then I will approach other retail dealers, tell them, ruin his reputation. Why should I be ruined alone? Pass it on to those responsible, hand hot potato back along line. But it must be done with utmost secrecy. Keep matter strictly between ourselves.